Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. Our upcoming discussion on social media and the First Amendment has been delayed but 1 week. So if you're here for that, please tune in for that next week, but stay with us tonight. I became aware of tonight's topic when, as a young public defender, I was involved in an injury accident. My cut-rate insurance carrier immediately tried claiming my policy covered right up to the midnight the day before the accident, resumed the following day, and that I was on my own. Well, that was a long time ago, and in my case, no real consequences in the end. But some folks are not that lucky. When people facing catastrophes after losing their house to a wildfire or a flood, or perhaps suffer major injuries after an accident, what do you do if there's a question of whether they're covered? Maybe there's a question of not just whether there's a policy in effect, but whether that policy applied to this kind of event. Tonight, we look at issues surrounding insurance coverage and the litigation that results from asserting that someone may or may not be insured. Questions regarding insurance coverage or insurance law in general or insurance claims, especially property or liability, disability, give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. For anybody that wants to call and have us pick up the freight, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. As always, our attorney guests cannot give you specific legal advice as we don't have all of the salient facts of your situation, but we're happy to share the legal principles to help guide your decision-making or maybe direct you to where you can find some help. You can contact us with any question of insurance law. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. And to guide us through this examination of insurance coverage and insurance claims, Tiburon attorney Kathleen DeFever is both an insurance a public adjuster and an insurance litigator with extensive experience and knowledge about insurance claims, the insurance market, and the experience of the insurance consumer. Ms. DeFever is one of the few professionals in the United States who's worked as both an insurance adjuster and an insurance litigator and has personally dedicated to the improvement of the consumer's experience with insurance. Having received her Master's of Insurance Law from the University of Connecticut School of Law, home of the world-renowned Insurance Law Center, and located in the world's insurance capital of Hartford, Connecticut, Kathleen is the author of the blog Misinsured. Also joining us tonight, back from speaking engagements and appearing tonight courtesy of the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen, Josh Borger. Josh is by now well known as a frequent guest and co-host on Your Legal Rights. Mr. Borger practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of arenas. Josh, Kathleen, both of you, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Thank you.
You know, I guess the first question I would have is, what does an insurance consumer attorney do?
Well, an insurance consumer attorney fields calls from those who have an insurance policy that they feel hasn't been paid appropriately, or they have a question about whether they have the correct coverage. And it can range from property insurance to disabilities to long-term care to business coverages. I mean, any question a consumer who purchased an insurance policy may have can call the insurance consumer attorney.
Are there attorneys who really spend most of their practice dealing with issues of coverage?
Well, an insurance consumer attorney is always dealing with issues of coverage. I can't think of an instance where I'm not addressing an issue of coverage because by default, my client is calling me asking about their policy coverages. Josh may be able to speak more about third-party instances in which it gets a little more complicated. My claims are always first-party claims, meaning the client calls and they are the first party, and the insurance company would be considered the second party. But sometimes you have a third party involved, such as with an auto accident. Maybe there were two people in the auto accident, and there are also then two insurance companies involved, and it gets more and more complicated. I don't usually address third party issues, but I think Josh does.
I do. And if we're asking whether there are people who specialize in this and only do this, there are. Certainly from either the plaintiff or the defense perspectives, there are firms that have entire divisions that are devoted to coverage work. Coverage is all lawyers learn contracts their first year, and contracts is that you're learning the interpretation. Nothing is higher and more complex in interpreting a contract than trying to interpret an insurance contract. Every word is going to have a list of cases defining that term. When you put them all together, you may think common sense tells you that it means A, but the law may decide that it means B. So you need someone like Kathleen in your corner who knows all of this law, all of these cases that have come down, to interpret your insurance policy, to tell you definitively what are your chances of getting money out of this situation from your insurance company or not. Most lawyers are not going to have that background, because it requires years of understanding, and it's just beyond what most of them are doing.
And the good news is that the courts of California have set forth a rule that if there's a dispute, there's an ambiguity in a term in a policy, it's interpreted in favor of the policyholder. Most people don't know that, and that's an extremely important leverage point for a consumer. So if the consumer calls and says, this term looks very confusing to me, does that mean I will be paid or does that mean I'm not going to be paid? If it's confusing, if it's ambiguous from the beginning, the court will interpret it in favor of what the policyholder would have believed that it meant. It's a very important part of the consumer insurance perspective.
You know, I wasn't going to dig this deep into the weeds just yet and get into these specifics, but I did get contacted from a listener who specifically asked, he's in the process of buying a home. He was setting up his homeowner's insurance, and he looked at the loss of use. And he's trying to figure what happens if, you know, perish the thought, what happens if he has a catastrophic fire and he's out of the house for a year? What does he have to say about where they place him for a year? Are they going to have to place him in something comparable, or would it be a motel or even an RV?
He is entitled to something comparable. It can be difficult when an area is ravaged by wildfires because you have so many people displaced. It can be very difficult to locate something comparable. So in some instances, the policyholder may end up in something better. And because they made a due diligent effort to find something comparable, the insurance company will still need to pay for something better. That actually happens, and happens recently with the regional wildfires that we have. But at the end of the day, what it's important for the insurance consumer to remember is that they are entitled to comparable. The insurance company will not tell you that, and they will suggest things that are cheaper because that saves the insurance company money. But you don't have to stay in something cheaper, that you have the right to stay in something comparable.
Well, let me follow up, if I may, Jeff. Kathleen, you're the expert on the first party policies. And for everyone's edification, you'll hear these terms out there, first party and third party. First party means that you are being paid for an injury that happened to you. The typical would be fire damage to your house. It's your house and you're going to be paid. Third party means someone is, for example, suing you. You're not looking to be paid by your insurance company, but you want your insurance company to pay them to make the case go away. And Kathleen is an expert on first party issues. During these claims, when people are wildfires and people had to leave their house, would you be entitled to any money typically if, for example, you weren't out of pocket and you were staying with family? Would you be entitled to a stipend at all for food during the day? What are your rights? Because everyone's going to have a different circumstance for what they need the money for.
Well, policies vary depending on which insurance company wrote the policy. But in general, and this is the vast majority of policies, yes, you're entitled to a stipend for food. You're entitled to monies to be fronted to you to buy clothing. I mean, if you put yourself in the shoes of someone who just lost their entire house and possibly any buildings around the house, just lost your entire life, basically, you've lost every belonging that you own. You're going to need quite a few things. You're going to need to run out and buy some clothes. You're going to need your toiletries, a lot of things that you wouldn't think about until it happens to you. Now, some of those items will come out of what's called contents coverage or personal property. So when you buy clothing because you need it right away, it will eventually come out of the contents coverage. But at the beginning, you don't need to worry about that. What you need to know is the insurance company is required to front you that money so that you can recover from the emergency and get to, as Jeff about, to a place where you can live temporarily, which is also paid for under typical homeowners insurance.
And we have another caller. Let me turn it over to Fred from the East Bay. Fred, you're on your legal rights.
Okay, thank you. I was scammed on the phone by someone, and I blame myself for it. But in any case, my insurance policy noted that I'm covered for ID theft up to $30,000, and yet it was denied because the insurance company said that I voluntarily, gave out my information, which resulted in my bank account being scammed. And that's true. I did voluntarily do it, which I'm totally embarrassed about. However, it wasn't completely willful because I was scammed. So according to insurance code section 533 in California, fraud can be, quote, voluntarily willful act of insured versus negligence of insured. And I'm claiming negligence, and I request some kind of fair degree of compensation, and that was denied. So I wondered if I have any further recourse.
The answer to that will be in the language of your policy. And I'm sure you've read it in great detail and tried to interpret it yourself. And so let me go back to what I said a few minutes ago. If your policy is ambiguous, and what I'm hearing from you is it sounds ambiguous, your situation is in the gray area where should that be covered? Is that intentional? Is it an accident? And the language you're reading in your policy is not giving you a clear answer. When the terms are ambiguous enough that you are confused, just the fact that you're calling and asking us this means that it's, I haven't seen it, of course, but it sounds like the terms in the policy are ambiguous, would mean that a court would interpret that in your favor.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I heard you say that, and that's quite eye-opening.
Yes.
And my policy does say that I'm covered for ID theft, but then the issue is, what's the definition of ID theft? And I'm saying, of course, that it was negligence due to being duped. And, of course, the insurance company is saying, no, you voluntarily gave the information, so we're not liable. So you have suggestions for me on next steps that I might take?
Fred, you brought up a good point before my guests have a chance to answer that. You brought up something that I wanted to circle back to that's a really overriding concern to any area of law. And that is one of the reasons I say if there's any doubt in your mind, it's a really good idea to seek the advice of an attorney to look at your policy and to sit down with you. It's a very small investment compared to what you probably have at stake if someone's cleaned out your account. And what I wanted to point out is that there are a lot of words that we use in common parlance, and they mean something to all of us commonly. But when you're in the legal arena or the medical legal arena, they may mean something much different or much more specific. So even if you really believe you understand your policy, it's well worth it to spend time. There may be case law that determines what those words mean as applied to your policy. And I'm sorry, with that background, let me turn it back to my guest. Josh, you looked ready to follow up.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure. And I agree with everything that Kathleen and Jeff have said. Let me add, it's not uncommon. In fact, I'll go as far as say it's quite common that insurance companies will deny your claims under these circumstances when you willfully did it. Not that you were intentionally doing something wrong. Everyone knows you didn't.
Yeah.
This comes up a lot in the wire fraud context.
Yeah.
Where people are losing vast sums of money, and these typically are not going to be covered by the insurance company. Because the way it happens is you get a fake wire instructions and you wired the money. Well,
right.
Everyone did what they were supposed to do. The bank, your bank did it. They followed the instructions. The receiving bank
got
a wire and they got the money. And then the person who on the other end stole the money. And so the insurance company will typically deny the claim under those circumstances. I think you're going to have an uphill battle in claiming that they have to provide cover. I haven't seen your policy again, but I think that you're going to have an uphill battle in claiming that you should be covered for the circumstance where you did. In this instance, it'll be interpreted, in my opinion, as willfully let go of your money is the way it's going to be seen. Not that you were willfully being a party to losing money. You were not trying to dupe yourself. willfully, I say that with all due respect. I do. But this happens all the time. It's wire fraud is awful. I've had people lose $500,000 in wire fraud that I've had to grab from all over the world. But when you willfully had someone do, even though it was fake wire instructions, the companies typically will not pay you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate your perspectives, and I thank you.
And if there's one thing I can stress, Fred, given the differing opinions of my guests and the differing languages and what they said, they each agree with the principles, but the answer is going to lie in the wording of your policy, and you really need to see somebody.
Okay. All right. Thanks so
much. Fred, also look at the definitions section of the policy because the definitions will control the wording. That's very important. And if it's not defined, it lends credibility to your interpretation again, because your interpretation will be considered more heavily, despite what might be in case law. But you know what? There is not a lot of case law on these identity coverages, so this is kind of an open field, if you will. I'm going to respectfully disagree with Josh. I think you might have a good chance at receiving coverage.
Yeah, or some of it, you know.
Kathleen is right that a lot of these cases are coming down. The wire fraud is very new. A lot of the cases are coming down from out-of-state authority, and oftentimes because of that, they may disagree. Or the Court of Appeal in California may simply disagree with those cases. And let me add one more thing about policy interpretation. And Kathleen, correct me if I'm wrong, but the court will first look at the policy, and if it's clear on its face, you're going to get what's clear on its face. If it's ambiguous, then coverage, what I call it as the wording that provides you with coverage, provides you with the money, is read broadly. They are a listing of exemptions is what they're called, at the end of the policy that restrict coverage and say, here are the circumstances in which you don't get it. That is read narrowly by the courts. I think Kathleen is giving me a thumbs up.
That's absolutely true. But I think in the identity section of the policy, I can't recall seeing much of that. So hopefully he's clear of that. It gets deep very quickly.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks so much, everyone.
Fred, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that first caller that had asked about the homeowner's policy, he's asking just as a follow-up, is it possible that despite what they're offering him or what they're putting up, that he could simply ask for an RV to use rather than putting up in hotels or things of that nature?
Yes, absolutely. You won't see any of that in the policy language, but it does happen regularly. If you prefer to purchase an RV rather than pay monthly somewhere, that can be done. It is done on a regular basis. The insurance company will likely argue with you about it. But remember, when you're making such a request, they're always looking at what's going to cost me the most in the long run. You may have a great argument that purchasing an RV costs them a lot less. So really look, really weigh those numbers and think about the best way to present that scenario to them.
Find a way to make it a win-win for both of you. That's the bottom line. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're taking a look at insurance. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topics, which is insurance, whether it's coverage, whether it's policy interpretation, whether it's insurance claims practices, anything you want. You're not limited to the point we may be in our conversation. You know, with any claim, we expect that there may be questions about causation, whose fault it is, or the amount of the damages or things. We expect those things to be looked at pretty clearly. But in what types of cases is coverage itself likely to be litigated?
Well, this goes back to the issue we were talking about of first party versus third party. And I will defer to Kathleen, who's the expert on first party coverage. But I think the one that you hear about so often is fire insurance. But I'll let her discuss this.
Not sure I understand the question, Jeff. Can you rephrase the question?
Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, we see these advertisements on TV. Don't worry about the insurance companies. Let me fight for you. Are they always the best person to be fighting when there's a question of coverage?
Well, it depends on what they're advertising. Yes, sometimes you'll see an attorney using language like this, and I would recommend, if they don't tell you what their specialization is, to get onto Google and find out what it is. Because oftentimes, attorneys who specialize in something other than insurance will try to rope insurance claims into the realm of what they practice. And I don't recommend hiring them if you have a specific insurance question, because as Jeff explained so well earlier, insurance law is a very, very specialized field.
Let me turn it over to Catherine from Oakland. Catherine, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, good evening. Thank you so much for taking my call. I live in the East Bay, and I was in a car accident, and I had an injury to my right eye. And since COVID, I have not been able to go in and see a doctor concerning my eye, you know, an optometrist specialist. So my, I forget what you call it, but my time frame is coming to a close this May. And I'm wondering, can I get an extension on my time frame since I just finally got an appointment with Kaiser for the eye exam? Can I request an extension?
Catherine, are you referring to your automobile insurance policy or your medical insurance?
Well, I think, you know, it's the carrier admits that they were going to pay my medical and you know, a little extra, I guess, as they said, for pain and suffering. Those are the only two elements I know that they would cover. But I really want to see an eye doctor before I discuss any further my case with the insurance company.
Kathleen, isn't this a claims-made policy where basically once the claim is open, the time is, for all intents and purposes, stand still?
I think that there's a 2-year, limitation.
I'm sorry, Catherine, that was meant for Kathleen, my guest, because she's the insurance expert.
So sorry.
I was just fleshing out your issue for you to help.
Oh, thanks. Okay.
But Catherine, we have almost the exact same name, so that could get confusing. My answer to that would be it doesn't matter because the insurance company is required to act reasonably. And so a lot of these time frame questions are coming up during COVID. What I would recommend that you do is put in writing a request to your insurer that says, I have not made it to the optometrist because, explain what you just explained to us and say, I need more time due to COVID. And they, because they have the requirement to be reasonable in their interactions with you, they should. Of course, I cannot guarantee any particular activity of an insurance company, but they should grant you more time, knowing mm-hmm. they need to be reasonable when they're extenuating circumstances. And maybe Josh could speak more to that because he has more experience on the insurance company side.
About the insurance company specifically, which part of it am I speaking to? Help me out.
Well, sorry to put you on the spot, Josh. That they have the duty to act in a fair manner toward the consumer.
I think we're venturing into the realm of bad faith right now is what we're calling
it.
Okay, sure. So there's a few different ways to answer this. There are regulations governing insurance companies when you tender a claim and there's time frames for what they have to do. And if they don't do them, you can report them to the Department of Insurance. Now, lawyers make the mistake that if you violate the regulations, you can sue them for violating the regulations. That you cannot do. It is not a law that allows you to sue them for violating. It's a rule that allows the insurance company to go after them for it. But it is evidence of what we call bad faith. And that comes up in both the context that Kathleen litigates a lot and deals with the first party, what we've called, and the third party, where if it really comes down to reasonableness. If the insurance company does not act reasonably, and that's going to be very different depending on the circumstance, whether it's first party, your house burned down, or third party, you're getting sued and you want it to go away, then you sue them not only for the coverage you didn't get, but because they acted in bad faith, you're going to get an extra level of damage, including, hopefully, the attorney's fees you had to spend on your attorney to get coverage. And the theory is, if they had acted reasonably, you wouldn't have had to have gotten a lawyer. So this is the general realm of what is a complex area of the law known as bad faith, when your insurance company doesn't act reasonably under the circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the moment, I do not have an attorney. So, it seems like they're kind of whittling down their offering to me, and I'm getting close to a 2-year, term come this May. So would your advice be get an attorney?
Catherine, of course, getting advice from an attorney is the best way to protect your rights and know that you're protecting all of your rights. But in the meantime, I would immediately put in writing to them what you're asking them for and why. Always put it in writing so that you can refer back to it. Here's a general tip. When you're on the telephone with an insurance company, they are not documenting what you're saying. Especially because that does not help them. They want to be able to refer back to a certain date and time they discuss something with you and only tell their side of the story. So always make sure that even when you're on the telephone, you're making notes about what you've discussed and then put the date on the notes you took and put it in mm-hmm. writing what you just told us and send that to them. But it does sound like you're coming up against a statute of limitations, so you might also want to talk to an attorney about that.
Yes, and is emailing adequate, just like writing a letter?
Yes, email is legally effective in the same way.
But make sure if you email it, you keep a copy somewhere. Don't rely on webmail alone. Not a reliable medium, necessarily.
I always blindside myself and have a return receipt when they open it.
Oh, yes. Okay. And one last question.
Catherine, before you I've got to interrupt for just a moment.
Oh, sure.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. We'll be back right after this.
Jon Batiste has had a big year. Not only is he the band leader for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, but he also won a Golden Globe for his work on the film Soul and played in the streets for the marches for Black Lives Matter last summer. Jon will tell you why he kept making music in an impossible year. It's coming up on Q from PRX.
Q from the CBC will be next at 7 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW here in San Francisco and online at kalw.org. And you're listening to Your Legal Rights here on Local Public Radio, KALW in San Francisco. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. For the details, you can dial 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org.
Catherine, you were just finishing up.
Yes, I just wanted to ask one quick more question. Now, I was in the midst of getting a teaching job while this accident happened, and so I was deferred from seeking a job because I went to physical therapy for 6 months. And I'm wondering, I was told by the insurance company, well, they wouldn't cover salary expenses because I wasn't actually hired at the time of the injury. Is that true? Is that the way it goes? There's no compensation for salary unless you've been working in a job for a certain time frame?
Well, Catherine, that would be in the specific policy language you have. So unfortunately, I cannot speak to that with any reliable answer. Now that you're bringing this second issue up, I think you really should seek an attorney's help to really look at your policy language. And, yeah, you know, after we just heard the message about finding attorneys through bar referrals, I'd like to also mention there's a insurance-specific nonprofit called United Policyholders. You can find them at uphelp.org, and they're wonderful. They will help you with some questions, and then they'll also help you find who else can assist if they don't know the answers.
And
well,
Catherine,
so
if all
much.
Else fails, you can always try to get an attorney through the Lawyer Referral Service of the Alameda County Bar Association. Their number is 510-302-2222.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. Best of luck to you. Let me turn it over to Daniel in Redwood City. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, good evening to everybody. Thanks. I'm a chiropractor in Redwood City, and I see personal injuries frequently under lien. The injured party is usually represented by an attorney. Over the years, things have changed a little bit for the worse for us chiropractors. It seems that attorneys will settle a claim and then go to the treating doctors and say, there's not enough money to go around, and we can't pay your bill in full. We need to reduce your bill by this amount. And it just seems to be almost a reflex response these days to expect that. Years ago, our liens were oftentimes paid in full or nearly paid in full. What options do I have here other than to not make myself available to take cases under lien with attorneys? And what do we do with a case where in one particular case I have, it's been out there for 2 years now waiting to settle. The patient was discharged and then came back 3.5 months later saying, oh, I'm hurting again. And I explained to her that, well, it would be hard for me to attach the pain you're having now with the auto accident, given the gap in treatment. But I said, let me call your attorney and talk to them about it. And if they agree to have me see you for another 6 visits, I will. But in no way am I going to reduce my bill, because now otherwise I'll be treating you for free for these visits. And do you agree with this? And she did. And we did the treatments and everything. I had the add-on $300 or $400 more to the bill. And now I'm getting letters from the attorney saying, the settlement offer is $15,000 and medicals come to $13,000. So with Kaiser and myself and so a couple of other medical providers. So what do we do? And the patient says, I'm not willing to. I think the case is worth more. I don't want to settle. So now the patient here is tying up any kind of settlement. Is that clear? is my question clear? I'm not sure.
Your question and your predicament to me are very clear. I did personal injury for all of 5 minutes, but enough to know that were I in your position with a practice on the line and dealing with these, I would not take cases on a medical lien. Unless it was somebody who I've worked with successfully and knew pretty well, I would want to know who the attorney was and if it's someone I trust, and someone I trust not to compromise my lien without at least talking to me first and making me a part of that consideration. But with that, let me turn it over to my experts. Kathleen, Josh, do you have any specifics that you would pass on to Daniel?
This seems like that, and look, there are so many medical professionals that will not take work under these circumstances because of the very predicament that you're talking about. It sounds like in the future, you might want to be one of them, where you're working for years, and then at the end of the day, you're being asked to shave off your bill to something negligible so that the whole thing can go away. You can refuse to compromise your bill. This is more of a practical situation that it's going to get out and you're not going to get hired anymore for these types of cases. But it sounds like you don't want these types of cases.
That's correct, especially in the one that I went into detail. I saw the patient for 41 visits, and frankly, I don't think she needed more than 31 visits. And so, with the settlement coming out, it would be ridiculous for me to compromise. And then I'm tempted to take the patient and the attorney to small claims court.
Yeah, I mean, that is your remedy. Look, maybe I don't know this situation, but there's a chance this person had 41 or would have wanted 50 visits because it would have increased the appearance of damages in that case. That's completely adverse to what you're looking for, which is treating somebody for free. Yes. And so it just seems like less of a lawyer and more of a person-to-person. This is the model that these people work under. This is not a model you're willing to accept. And I would say take them to small claims, get what you can, and don't do this with plaintiff lawyers anymore.
Or if you do it with ones that you know well and that won't use you to try to build up damages to create a straw man and then leave you hanging. Only do it with ones that you trust.
Well, that's true. I feel bad for the person involved in the car accident, too, and want to help them out. And I'm using it as a form of advertisement too to reach out, but it seems, where does the settlement go then in the attorney's pocket, and then hopefully some to the injured party's pocket too, of course, and then they leave the treaters out to dry.
Well, the purpose is for the attorney as a fiduciary duty to their client. So speaking frankly, their duty isn't to get you paid in a large sum. Their duty is to get you to compromise as much as possible so that their client can get paid. And most of these cases, they're working on a contingency. So the less you get paid, the more they get paid. Uh-huh. No one has an incentive to do anything less than compromise your bill down to the smallest amount possible. And if you're not willing to accept that, don't do this work.
For what it's worth, I'm in the same geographic region that you are, even though I don't I don't practice personal injury or really anything civil. I do practice out of Redwood City, and I can tell you from my own practice of law and my participation in the Bar Association in San Mateo County, there are very reputable attorneys practicing personal injury in Redwood City who I would be much more likely to trust than perhaps some others.
Oh, I agree. And these days, but most of the people that I'm talking about are English as a second language, or don't speak English at all, and they're watching Latin television, and they're getting commercials from personal injury attorneys, primarily in Los Angeles, and they're biting on them. And so I'm with the patient already comes to me represented, and even if they haven't done it, if the attorney hasn't done anything, you know, they don't want to necessarily get rid of that attorney for fear of having to pay that attorney something, even though they maybe have just signed a contract.
I don't want to discriminate against people in other places, but in general, you're far better off having relationships with attorneys or anyone else that's local that won't necessarily be gone in a week. If you have somebody that has to appear in the same place periodically, they generally have an incentive to work it with a different level. Local attorneys, you'll probably not face that to the same extent as ones that are coming in from other places that are gone after this case.
I agree.
Daniel Wister, best of luck, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Nice program. I'll continue to listen. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me turn it over to Friend in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, this is Fran. I just wanted to make a comment to the lady who said she wants to see an optometrist and wanted an extension. I just want to say it would be an ophthalmologist who does anything serious with the eyes, and the optometrist is the person who does the glasses.
No, I appreciate that, Fran. All three of us are smiling as you said that. I think all of us interpreted her as meaning that. She just didn't say that.
Yes.
She did mention that she's a Kaiser patient, and I would presume she's talking about an MD rather than an OD.
Yeah. Well, it's important for her case to distinguish difference. I mean, she could see an optometrist, but I think that for her purposes, the ophthalmologist is the one. That's all I wanted to say.
No, I appreciate that. That's why your legal right. We are your legal rights rather than your medical rights. But thank you for that. I think we all share that.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Let me turn it over to Don from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. Yes, I have a question on a real estate transaction. I'm in a contract to buy an apartment in San Francisco, and the seller has yet to be able to produce a clean title. Basically, they did some renovations on the apartment that encroached on exclusive common area. They are promising to get back with a, you know, redone CCNRs and condo map and recorded deed, but it's now 2 days away from escrow. So I'm worried about losing our rate that's locked in. You know, I have to pay another month's rent on my apartment. Is there any remedy that I can get any sort of damages from the seller, or what would you suggest that I pursue in this case?
Well, this sounds like less of an insurance matter. They haven't given you a title report showing that they have clean title. You're not claiming that you have a report that shows they have clean title when, in fact, they do not have clean title, correct?
Yes, they do not have clean title. The map shows, and my real estate agent showed it. No, it's not an insurance matter, you're right, but it did show that they made renovations into exclusive common area, not to their own deeded plot. So
my point is, if they gave you a report that said they have clean title to give you, and it turns out they do not have clean title, then you would have a claim against for title insurance because you did not get clean title. But that is not what you're claiming. This doesn't sound like an insurance matter. It just sounds like a breach of contract matter at this point.
Right.
And you would, okay. I mean, then you have remedies for under the purchase and sale agreement to either they've breached it and you're going to want out of it and all your money back, or your remedy is going to be to force the sale and then you're going to get it with the title issue. But again, right. this sounds more like a real property issue than an
right.
insurance issue. But you have rights and remedies, most of which are detailed in the purchase and sale agreement that you have. If you're 2 days before a close, they are well past the point when they can back out of it. Now, if
right.
they guaranteed you clean title and they're not doing that, then for breach of contract, you would be able to back out of it, but they wouldn't be.
Right.
I suggest
right.
you contact a lawyer who handles real estate deals, breach of contract deals. And actually, that's
right.
a fair amount of what I know.
Okay.
Sounds like a real property attorney. I agree.
Yeah. Okay. Good. good. I'll pursue that option then. Thanks for your input on that.
Thank you. Welcome again to Your Legal Rights, and have a great night. Let me turn it to Jocelyn in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yes, hi. Do you hear me?
Yes, we hear you, okay. And you're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I don't have a particular case, but when in the beginning you mentioned long-term care insurance, legal or illegal issues on that, and I just wondered if your guests had any experience with how reliable the long-term care insurance companies are, if and when I need it, and whether or not I can expect to be having legal problems in terms of being paid for care in the future.
Well, Jocelyn, unfortunately, long-term care is a field that insurance companies entered and wrote some very nice policies for the policyholders and then realized quickly that they were losing money on those policies. So I'm not sure when you bought your policy, but it could mean one of two things. If you have one of the better policies from years ago, that's wonderful news. You have better coverage. However, that might mean that they fight harder to pay you less. If you have a recent policy, you might have an easier time being covered because it covers less of the financial need that you may have. But then, of course, you don't have as much coverage. I mean, that's a very broad answer to what you're asking me. That's a portion of the insurance industry that is in flux right now.
And Jocelyn, we lost her call. She's taking her call, her answer on the air. But it would make sense. I tend to agree. Josh, do you see it any differently? Or
nope. I couldn't have said it better myself.
So let me ask a couple other questions. For example, you know, insurance premiums have gotten very expensive. And one thing that people toy with at times is maybe fudging the information just a little bit, try to bring the premiums down. What danger is there in that?
Well, if there's anything that's incorrect or dishonest in your insurance application, it won't matter how long you've paid premiums to your insurance company. If when you make a claim, they discover something was dishonest, they not only can keep your premiums and deny your claim, they can also sue you for fraud. And so I never recommend even putting in something you're not sure about into the application. Be extremely honest and straightforward.
I couldn't agree more. My background is a little different than Kathleen's. I spent a long time representing the insurance companies, and I can tell you when it ends up in litigation and someone has a large claim that was handling what were known as complex claims, which are multi-million dollars, I'm scouring the application to see if anything in there is untrue. And if it is, when you sue for your breach of contract in bad faith, we're going to countersue, and it's going to be what means to rescind the policy. That is to say the policy does not and never did exist because it was based on a lie. You do not want to be in that situation.
So two realtors represent that they're partners in order to get on a group policy when, in fact, their practices are across town. It would suggest that perhaps they'd be okay for a routine visit or for a prescription, but you know, one of them gets a brain tumor, somebody's going to be combing through that policy and waiting and saying, wait a minute, you're not a group. What is this? You're shaking your head, Josh. Is that?
You lost me a little bit on the question, but let me just say, yeah, going back to it, if you put something in the application and it is not 100% accurate, then instead of paying the claim, there is a very high chance the insurance company is going to countersue to rescind the policy. So we can spin that out with hypotheticals. But if it is not true at the time that you wrote the application, they will find out. It is their job to find out, and they will move to rescind the policy. And then you will end up having spent a lot of money in attorney's fees for no earthly reason.
I'd like to add on the flip side, I often get questions of why is the insurance company asking me these really detailed questions on a topic I don't think is even related to this type of insurance? And you don't, the answer is, you don't always have to answer those questions. There's a fine line between your privacy and what they need to know. And that would be something I mentioned earlier, United policyholders. I would call them and ask them what they think about it. I don't think that would be an issue you'd want to call an attorney for and have them bill you the hourly rate for a question that can be answered very quickly. But that comes up a lot, and that can have a huge impact on when you do make a claim later. From a consumer attorney's perspective, we see that insurance companies fish for extra information because they look for ways to deny you later, even if it's something that you never saw coming. You could fill out an application for a policy and then 5 years later find out that they had asked you a question that was geared toward looking toward limiting your coverage when you made the claim in 5 years. So when you fill out the application, think hard about what they're asking you and why. You have a privacy interest in a lot of your details. And one that comes up a lot particularly is tax returns. You do have a privacy interest in your tax returns, and no one should ask you to just turn them over without any excellent reason. And so always question that if you see that as a request.
Let me turn it over to Evan and Hayward. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Greetings, and don't hesitate to give me short shrift if I'm too far off topic, but I had a question. In the event where a claim may end up with litigation, can you comment on how the COVID situation closure of the courts may have told the statutes of limitation?
Well, I can answer. It has not told, I don't believe it's told the statute of limitations. Right now, for example, if you file a lawsuit so that the statute of limitations no longer runs, it may take the court a while to process it. And even, let's say, hypothetically, that it took 3 months to process it. If I filed it today and it's processed 3 months from now, it gets stamped today, even though it's not processed 3 months from now.
So Evan, I'm going to suggest this is one that you definitely want to talk to somebody about the specifics of your case. And I don't want to give it short shrift right now, because there were specific orders, emergency orders by the Supreme Court. I don't practice civil law, so I can't go into the specifics of what type of case you have and what statute you're going to fall under. But there were some time limits that were told. So it may be that the limit for making a claim is not told, but the limit for making a complaint has been. But it's going to be somewhat case specific depending on which statute you fall under. So I really think you want to probably talk to somebody about your specific case.
Very good.
Again, if you want to get an opinion from someone at the Lawyer Referral Service, 510-302-2222.
Thank you very much.
Evan, thank you for joining us. And let me turn it to Roy in San Francisco.
Hi. I wondered if when you're getting medical insurance, they ask if you smoke, if you vape, should you say yes?
Roy, that's an excellent question. I do not know the answer to that. I don't know if vaping is being considered under a legal definition as smoking. Does anyone else know? I'm not seeing anyone.
I looked at an old voter pamphlet, and it appears that a guy named Leno ran through a bill that equated smoking and vaping in California. But I never equated them. The only thing they have in common is nicotine. So, but listening to you before, my alarm bells went off in my head.
Well, what I would do is, here's another tip. If you have an application with, you know, limited lines to write on, or a box that only says yes or no, but you're not sure, maybe the answer is more complicated than that, you're welcome on that application to write, maybe I vape. I'm not sure that's considered smoking.
Yeah, I already got the insurance. I'm wondering if I should write them and tell them at the time I filled out the application, I thought smoking and vaping were separate, but they should know I vape.
I, you know, it's better to be more open about a subject like that. As Josh warned, if the insurance company thinks that in their interpretation, they really think vaping is obviously smoking, they can argue that you lied on your application. And that's just not an argument that you would like to get into. So I would recommend calling whomever you contacted when you filled out the initial information and say, I need to clarify that I did not intend to be misleading in any way, but I've been thinking about it and I'm not sure I answered correctly.
Okay.
I would second it and say I absolutely agree with Kathleen, because if you do correct it and you make a claim 3 years from now and then they try to rescind the policy claiming you lied, they're not going to succeed because you corrected it and they accepted your premiums for 3 years. So they will not be able to claim that they relied upon that statement that you corrected years ago in giving you that policy.
They might increase my premium, but they...
Well, we're not sure about that, but they won't be able to yank it.
Yeah.
In response. In fact, you can get sued for bad faith for doing that, for trying to yank it in bad faith. You, the insurance company, can get sued for bad faith actions.
Yeah, but it's a lot tougher now since Rosebird is gone.
There is that, but that's a whole different show. Roy, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights. We are basically at the end of the hour, and I wanted to give each of my guests no more than a minute, probably 45 seconds or so, for any closing remarks that you care to make. Kathleen, you want to jump in first?
Sure. I wanted to add to our discussion. You had mentioned in my description of my work that I'm also a public insurance adjuster. Most people don't realize public insurance adjusters exist. So I would like to explain why they exist and what they do. We are like insurance consumer attorneys, but if you have an issue with the insurance company that you don't believe warrants a legal interpretation, then you would contact the public insurance adjuster, because public insurance adjusters only represent consumers. And you're probably aware there are insurance adjusters internally at your insurance company. Well, on the flip side, there are also adjusters who represent only consumers. And so they are open to answering questions up until that point that it's a legal interpretation. I myself happen to be both. So if you contact me, I can also tell you, oh, that's a question for an adjuster, or that's a question for a lawyer. But it's incredibly valuable knowledge to know that public insurance adjusters exist. And I wanted to make sure that the audience knows that, because that's a resource that most persons don't even know they can contact.
Josh, you want to take about 30 seconds?
Sure. A building is filled with methane. There's a case in Colorado that building is a property loss, even though structurally it's fine. In California, it is not. My point, interpretation of insurance policies is incredibly complex, and what you think it means when you read it may not be even close to what the courts think it means. I would defer to an attorney who's a specialist in the area when in doubt.
And this brings back Roy's question about smoking and vaping. It doesn't matter if your building is full of methane. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights as we took a look at the current environment of insurance law. Our guests tonight have been Josh Borger from the San Jose office of Berliner Cohen and Kathleen DeFever, DeFever Law in Tiburon. Tonight's show was produced by yours truly. Please be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, Wednesday at 6 o'clock, where we will take a look at the First Amendment and social media. Again, a big thanks to tonight's guests, and our thanks to all of you for joining us. And at the controls, Damian D. Minor. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and stay safe.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. And if you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. You can call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. ¶¶